Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial Black Dad Podcast. It's your host, Aaron Mayo. This is episode 6. Today, I have what I consider one of the smartest people I know on the podcast with me. This guy, actually, I go back with all the way to high school. Good friend. Our families are good friends. Like I said, I've known him for a long time. So I want to welcome Alan Johnson onto the podcast here with me. What's going on, Alan?
Just chilling, man. How about you?
Same, man. Just chilling. Before we even kind of jump into anything, I want to kind of jump in with you. I like to kind of start off everything with kind of like I call it like a rapid fire, just like 5 random questions I have. So I want to start there, and then we'll kind of transition into everything else.
Sounds good? Sounds good.
All right, cool. So I know you spent some time in New York, and I know you spent a good amount of time in Chicago. So this is always a debate, and I'd love to know what your thoughts are on this. But when it comes to pizza, are you a New York or a Chicago pizza guy?
Yeah, I question a lot. I think it's sort of a trick question, because I think it's the, at least if you're comparing like, you know, like classic New York, like, you know, thin crust style with like Chicago deep dish.
Yeah.
Those are two different foods.
Yes. Very, very different. Very, very different.
You gotta be in a different sort of mood.
Yeah.
To eat a slice of deep dish. So, you know, I would say like, if I'm like in a hurry, trying to get from point A to point B, then, you know, a New York slice is the way to go. But if I want to sit down and I've been preparing my stomach for the entire day in a special occasion, then, yeah, you know, there's nothing like some Lou Malnati's.
I remember like the first time I had Chicago style pizza, I was like, what do you mean I have to use a fork and a knife to eat it? And then I saw it and I was like, yeah, I definitely need a fork and a knife to eat this. And two slices are a meal itself.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You're definitely bringing home some leftovers that you'll be like eating on for like the rest of the week.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, the Chicago style deep dish is a commitment. New York, like you can literally walk and eat it and be fine.
Yeah, yeah. Although I think what one thing people don't realize is that Chicago is also known for thin crust, like the crispy thin crust, and I probably prefer that to most of like you know, like the New York like floppy, you know,
yeah, folded over.
I don't fold ever though, you know.
Yeah. No, I'm not a fold guy either. So no, I hear you.
I handle my, you know, and take my floppy pizza on the chin. You just gotta.
That's the way you gotta do it. All right, so I'm gonna move on to my next one. What, in your opinion, what are your top 3 movies of all time to you?
Oh man, that's a tough one. You know, I saw, you know, I can't really commit to this, but so I'm just going to go off the top of my head.
Okay.
I finally saw both Citizen Kane and Casablanca. I was not disappointed. Like, you know, I figured those movies couldn't possibly live up to like their like outsized reputation.
Right.
Both are phenomenal movies. Okay. So I'm going to put those, I'll put those up there. And then I'm going to cite a movie that maybe is probably not like like one of my actual favorites, but when I first saw the movie Traffic, I think I was in like middle
school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So $5, $6, you know, dollar movie.
Yeah, right.
And that's like one of the first movies that I recall like watching and really being like, you know, and really noticing like cinematography, you know. Yeah. It had a big ensemble cast, like, you know, it was the moral complexity of the plot. It was like, I think that's the movie that turned me on to movies, generally speaking.
Ludacris was in that movie, right?
Yeah.
Remember, I know I've seen it. It's been a while, but yeah, that's a really good movie. I definitely agree with you. That's a great movie.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on then. I know you played rugby for a few years.
Yep. Still
So, okay, you're still playing a little bit.
sometimes, like once or twice a year.
Man, that's a pretty physical sport.
Yeah, for sure.
What's to this point? What's your most memorable moment playing rugby? Whether it be like a hit or like a big game or like what's the thing you remember or the thing that sticks out in your mind the most?
Well, when I was probably in like my peak shape, when I was playing in grad school, I had to play for the B side, like kind of like the second team, because it's a grad student, like in those days. And I don't know if they changed it or whatever, but like you weren't technically allowed to play in like the games that like counted for, like standings and stuff like that. And
Oh, okay.
so even as I was getting like better at the sport, like I ended up just being like the best player on the B side team. So there was like one game where like I was having to carry a ton of load, like make all the tackles, do all the distributing. Like it was crazy. And I remember hitting two dudes at once and then like standing up, and I knew I'd hurt my shoulder. But I was like, all right, well, I'll just have to tackle with the other shoulder. And so then every tackle, I just try to push myself to go in with the left shoulder. And it was a crazy game. It was a lot of fun. I can't remember if we won or lost, but I remember at the end of the match, I go over to the trainer. I'm like, I think something's wrong with my shoulder. And he's like, can you raise your hands above your head? And like one arm, my left arm goes up like normal. My left hand just goes up like basically even with my shoulder. And he's like, I'm pretty sure you still shoulder. So I realized after the fact that I played like half a game with a separated shoulder and not even it. But it was pretty minor injury, I guess. Like I just spent like 2 weeks with my arm in a sling, and then I was back probably like 2 weeks later or something like that.
And with the separated shoulder, they have to like pop it back in, right?
No, they don't have to. They
Okay,
didn't have to do
okay.
anything. You can
All right.
get like surgery for it. It's technically like a one or two blown out tendons, but as it
Okay,
turns out,
okay.
you don't actually need them.
Oh, really? Okay. So you didn't even, so you don't have, like, those tendons are gone right now, but you're fine.
So like the end of your collarbone pokes up for, I guess the rest of your
Okay.
but you got other backup tendons, so it's not really an issue.
you've got a great story to tell. So there you
Yeah,
go.
yeah.
Actually, I'm curious, man. What got you interested in rugby?
It's kind of a funny story. I mean, I studied abroad in Wales, and my Welsh roommates were rugby players, but I didn't actually get into it. They taught me how to toss the ball the way that you do, kind of like underhand style. I never actually tried the sport when I was there. And then when I first got to grad school, I was like at the I was in the grad school dorms, and a dude who became like one of my best buddies. This is like one of the first like couple of I don't know, maybe in the first couple of weeks of being there. He was like dressed up like he was like gonna go work out. I'm like, you head to the gym, man? He's like, no, I'm going to rugby practice. I was like, word? He was like, do you play in undergrad or anything? He's like, no, I'm just gonna give it a try. So I'm like, well, dude, I'm gonna throw on some clothes. I'll go out there with you. So we both ended up playing. We were like, just trying it out and everything. And I was just blown away by the a whole bunch of different aspects of like the sport itself and the rugby team. This was at Princeton University. And like the coach there is like the best coach I've had like in any sport in my career. He's like family to me. He's nicest dude in the world, and just like a brilliant coach. And I was just like hooked on the sport the more I started to learn about it. Like I got like a it's the there are a lot of rules, but they're like they allow for a lot of creativity, and they allow teams to specialize in different ways. And so it's like it's a very like a free-flowing game, at least when it's at least good matches tend to be pretty free-flowing. And like if you're in a lot of sports, you throw the ball in if it goes out of bounds. In rugby, you can throw the ball into yourself. It's crazy. Really?
Huh. Wow.
He's like, I didn't know you could do that. But it's like, yeah. If something's not specifically disallowed, then you can do it. So that kind of allows for a lot of, like, you know, creativity and like cleverness.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I don't really know a lot about rugby, but it's definitely one of those things where you don't necessarily hear someone every day saying, "Hey, I play rugby." So, like, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a great sport.
Yeah. I'll have to learn more about it. All I know is it basically, to me, it's like very minimally padded football.
Yeah, sort of, but it's not as dangerous. Well, I don't know. That's probably arguable. It's not as dangerous. I guess I'll put it that way. Because when you tackle someone, you have to actually wrap them with your arms and bring them to the ground. Like, there's no just like shoulder charging someone.
Gotcha. No truck sticks.
Yeah. And so that kind of changes up the whole game. Like, you get thrown out if you knock someone over and you've not actually held on to them. So it kind of changes. Is as much as you don't have pads, that also means people have to be a little bit more careful.
Right.
And it turns out to, you know, perhaps make it like, you know, as safe or maybe somewhat safer, but people still get concussed and all that kind of stuff. So it's not all that safe.
Yeah. I'll definitely have to, learn more about that. 'Cause it sounds interesting.
Yeah. Check, you know, if sevens is really easy to get into. I think there's actually a sevens tournament this weekend, like a international sevens World Cup or something like that. That's the version of the sport they had in the Olympics this past time around. And it's like 7 minute halves, only seven players on each side. It's really fast paced, lots of scoring. It's simpler than like the bigger game, which is 15 people on each team on the field all at once.
Okay, so that sounds like it would be a pretty fast pace with only seven. Like, okay.
It's a really exciting form of the game.
Huh. All right, cool. Yeah, I'll look out for that. So I wanna move on. This is different question, but what, in your opinion, what's the best piece of advice that's ever been given to you?
Oh man, that's
I know that's kind of a tough one.
I don't know.
Hmm.
Best piece of advice. I don't know. I'm struggling to really, I don't know. I guess while I'm still on the rugby mindset, like the, you know, one of the things that like our coach always emphasized is that like, in rugby, like the team is basically as strong as its like weakest link, you know. So it's like the other team will capitalize on that one player who's not making a tackle, you know.
Right.
So you kind of have to. It kind of exposes, you know, you know, it puts that level of accountability on you that when your team is backed up against the line, like you don't want to be that guy who lets down everyone else by just like whiffing or not fully committing, you know?
Right.
I think, like, I guess it's not necessarily advice, but something I took away from the game is like just that mindset of, you know, of both like teamwork and individual accountability, you know?
Right. Like it's bigger than you.
For sure.
But you play a big part in it.
You know, exactly. Like that kind of duality.
Yep. All right. I like it. So my next question, and this actually is going to lead me into a topic I want to talk about with you. So I know that you spent a couple years teaching in the Baltimore school system. So I know you saw a lot of things, and you and I went to the same high school, Naperville North, which is, a pretty privileged area, pretty privileged high school.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Where you were was pretty much the opposite of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's one thing, if you could change, that you think would improve the educational system in inner cities?
Yeah, so I think fundamentally the problem is that, like, you've got so many kids that have so many diverse different needs, Like, I think there's like sort of stereotypes of what like a kid from the inner city, like what their life experience might be. And I think that sort of papers over just how different everyone's life experience like actually is, So like all the things that like you've heard are true of somebody, but not necessarily true of everyone or like all at the same time. And I think one of the things that the schools really fail at are is addressing the people in like the deepest level of need. I think there needs to be like a, I think more than anything, there has to be like kind of a ethic of start with the people who need the most and then work up from there. Because I think so many things get done that effectively like, scoop off the people who are most likely to succeed, like scholarship programs, like, or charter schools. Like most of these things end up addressing like within, within every slice of every way that you can slice like the population, there are always going to be people who are like relative haves and relative have-nots. And so many things we do address people who are on the relative have side of whatever slice you're talking about. And I think what ends up happening is that like the people in the greatest levels of need like just get neglected. And I have a hypothesis that if you were to do the exact opposite and start with the people of the greatest need, maybe those folks need a smaller setting, classrooms of like six or something like that. I think that would make education, as you go up the chain of more and more fulfilled needs, I think it would make it a lot more efficient, because you kind of end up with like the services that are being provided to sort of everyone being swamped by need and only really addressing the people who are relatively well off. So it's frustrating though.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine. Yeah, I've actually I'm interested in the educational field. My grandmother worked in education for a long time. My mom at some points has worked in the school systems. So it's always interesting to me. And I know, like, with the No Child Left Behind, it was one of those things where even if kids weren't achieving at the level they were supposed to, they were still being pushed along. And it's kind of like, how does that help the kid in the long run? That's kind of setting them up for failure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's definitely I like before and after No Child Left Behind. They call it social promotion, like where it's like pressure that you want to keep these kids with peers that are of their same age, If they're we're talking oftentimes kids who've had their education disrupted because their family has moved, or like one of a whole bunch of different possible life events. One of the things that was frustrating to me is that it's not as though there aren't, like, especially in a place like Baltimore, like hundreds of kids that all share like similar like levels of disruption. So it's like you could say that, like, all right, so we've got some 14-year-olds and they've really only completed up to like a sixth grade education. Like you could say, like, all right, well, let's bundle up some of the folks that are all in the same situation and address like their actual needs, Like, so this need of social promotion to like keep them with their other peers, I think is sort of just invented because it makes things like simpler for us to think about, but ultimately doesn't serve their needs at all.
I agree. So, and one thing that I appreciate you doing is when we kind of started setting up this conversation, you sent me over a link to your blog. So I know you worked for Teach for America for a couple of years, actually while you were in graduate school. Man, how'd you pull
Yeah, it was crazy. So
that
like I had just finished like the grad program I was at in Princeton. And then when you do Teach for America, you could possibly already have a teacher certification, but the program's designed so that you don't have to. And so if you don't have one, then you usually the law for whatever state or district you're operating in is that you're provisionally certified to teach, but you have to be on the path to like getting your actual certification.
Oh, okay.
Usually that's like through education grad school that, you know, that area. So when I started, I was, you kind of have the choice. You can either be on the pathway to earn your master's, usually a master of arts in teaching, or you could just minimum that it takes to get certified. Gotcha. When I started though, I was like, you know, I made the move into teaching, very open to the idea that that might just be like my career going forward. And so, I enrolled in the master of arts in teaching program to, you know, to finish my master's within the same 2 years that I was doing Teach for America, which is actually like what, you know, I would say probably like 75% of the people who were in my, you know, they call it a core, like basically your cohort of people who are going into the same region and stuff, probably like 75-80% of people like aim to do the master's in 2 years. I ended up dropping down to just doing the minimum that I needed for certification after 1 year doing it, because it's wild. Like, you're a full-time teacher, a full-time grad student, like all at the same time. It's like the most, by far the most intense experience of my life.
Yeah. And everyone that's listening should, if you have a chance, check out Alan's blog. It's called alanjteaching.wordpress.com. And it really kind of takes you into a lot of the things that you were dealing with at the time. And like you were saying, like, it sounds like when you were teaching, you were putting in a minimum of 10-hour days just at the school, and then having to go home and create lesson plans as well as graduate school. What were your nights looking like? Like, how many hours of sleep were you averaging back then?
Probably like, you know, it's tough to remember, but I mean, up to like at least midnight on most nights.
Yeah,
up at like probably like 5:45 in the morning. Mm. So it was wild. I mean, I think eventually I got into a better flow, but especially when you're just starting, like it's nuts. And I have friends who, you know, that taught multiple what they call preps. So if you teach, you know, like let's say you're teaching algebra and geometry and algebra 2 all at the same time, you can be assigned to teach up to 3 preps in the same semester. Mm-hmm. I know people were working even harder than I was. Mm. But yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that like really sets me off is like when people think that like teachers are, you know, aren't hardworking. You know, they're like, school's only in session for 6 hours a day and you get the summers off. You have no idea.
yeah, right. It's so much more than that. I know it's so much more than that.
It's crazy. Yeah, the number of hats you wear is so nuts. I mean, granted, at some point, if you teach for enough years and you teach the same subjects, then like you can, it gets simpler. Like, because you might not have to rewrite your entire lesson plans, you know, for every single day. You know, you're more doing modifications, but but it's still a lot of work, even once you have like a good flow for it.
Mm-hmm. So when I was reading your blog, I started thinking about a TV show that I watched probably about a year ago. Have you ever heard of Last Chance High?
No. Oh, you know what? I think I saw like promos for it, but I never watched it.
I believe it came on Viceland, I think it was.
And they were in like Chicago or something, right?
Yeah. So when I was reading your blog, a lot of the things that you were talking about, you know, being at a charter school and having some problem kids that would disrupt the class for pretty much everyone. This show kind of was the same. It was a charter school in Chicago. They were taking in a lot of kids that had behavioral disorders and, you know, just not the best situations overall. And they were trying to help them and give them an education and help them to move along. And, you know, some kids were able to benefit from it and push through. And, you know, they weren't able to reach some kids and they went down the wrong path. So, yeah, when I was reading your blog, I couldn't help but think about that. So, and then also with you being in Baltimore, every time I think about Baltimore, I think about The Wire.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I'm assuming you've seen The Wire.
Yeah. I think it's the greatest thing ever put on television.
How accurate was it? Like, what kind of perception did you have before you went to Baltimore?
I mean, I knew Baltimore was a rough city. I didn't know. I had never spent a huge amount of time there, but you know, growing up, like, you know, going to Gary and Detroit in the 90s, like when they were like, both, like really, like, you know, like particularly rough and, less like less kind of depopulated as they sort of are today. Yes. Like, you know, I had a feel for what, you know, the kind of inner city environment would be like.
Yeah,
but I didn't know much about Baltimore specifically. I watched most of The Wire like as I was getting ready to start teaching and stuff.
Okay.
I think the last season happened like while I was in Baltimore.
Okay.
But I kind of, you know, I wanted to limit to an extent like how much you know how much I wanted to have like preconceived notions.
Right.
But at the same time, it was like Wire was kind of like required viewing. Like, you know, this is what everyone in the city was talking about. Like, you know, so you kind of have to, you had to, that was like the least you could do.
Yeah.
In terms of the accuracy, it's kind of difficult to say in the sense that like The Wire covers a lot of what's going on in like these students, like home lives, like in season four, when they start to bring in like the, you know, the focus on the education system. It's almost like my life was kind of like Prez's life as a teacher, you know, where you have a limited window into like what's going on in the lives of your kids, like outside of your classroom. So it's a little bit, you know, so it's tough for me to speak on like the accuracy of, you know, a lot of what's on The Wire. Yeah. I would say that like when it comes to like the actual experience in the classroom, it's like a lot less like, I guess a lot of the things that happen, like, you know, you remember like the one kid gets slashed with like a razor like in class, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, nothing like that violent ever happened in like, you know, at my school when I was there. Okay. But I know someone who you know, one of my peers in Teach for America, let a kid go to the bathroom. Like, the kid was doing like the bathroom dance and everything. Mm. And apparently, like, when he got out of the classroom, he pulled and went to another classroom, dragged another kid out of class and stabbed him. Like, wow. So it's not as though like this stuff doesn't happen. It's just that, like, you know, I think people would get the wrong impression if they thought that that's like how it is every day. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think like the real experience in some ways is like it's much more grinding and much more, I don't know, kind of difficult in like much more like mundane ways, I guess you could say, you know.
I got you.
Like, one of the things I remember is just kind of this constant feeling that like felt like opportunities were slipping away for, you know, for some of the most clear pathways to better education, better professional opportunities, better life opportunities. Like, it felt like I had a clear idea of like what it would take to be prepared for college and all this other stuff. And it was just so difficult to translate that understanding to the students. And it, because like I wasn't able to do that, you kind of just feel like those, you know, as freshman year is going by and they're like getting ready for the tests and like all this kind of stuff, like, and you just feel like the opportunity is just drying up. And it's really difficult on an emotional level to kind of persist through, you know, when you feel like you're just like, you know, taking L's day after day.
Kind of like you're swimming upstream. Like, you've got the current fighting against you at all times, and you're still trying to get to where you want to go. But yeah, you got a lot of things that are kind of preventing you from doing that. Yeah, that's gotta be frustrating, especially again going back to the amount of time that you're putting in on a daily basis, and then to not really kind of see the rewards or kind of see the benefits of it. I know that's gotta be a little frustrating.
Yeah, it's deeply, deeply disheartening. Like, you know, and it's not even so much like the time put in, but it's just like, you know, ultimately you're trying to solve this puzzle of like, how do you, you know, it's like 100 individual puzzles, really, you know, because every kid has got different outlook, different motivations, different everything. And you're trying to figure out how do you get everybody sort of moving forward in the right direction. You know, and when it feels like you're just like, you know, you're not making it like nearly the progress that you'd hope to be making. It's really disheartening.
So I'm curious to get your perspective on this, but so Teach for America, it's a 2-year commitment, right?
Right, right.
And do the students know that you are up from Teach for America, or are they unaware?
They're aware if you tell them, I guess.
Okay. So, no, my question is, I'm wondering, like, if the student's aware, because I'm going back to when I was a student, and if I know, like, all right, this teacher's only going to be here for a couple years and they're leaving, I might not necessarily take them all that serious. So
right.
I'm wondering, like, if you feel like that could have been the mindset, or even if they knew that you were part of the program.
You know, I don't know. I'm sure I mentioned at some point I was part of the program, but you know, it's kind of like the, you know, the students would have to like look it up online. They have to be really interested independently, kind of like understanding what the program's about in order to really have much of an opinion on it.
Okay.
Like, you know, I should say that I went in like really open to the idea that I would teach for, you know, for many years,
yeah,
you know, or perhaps even my whole career.
Yeah.
So, I didn't know I was only going to teach for 2 years, and certainly my students wouldn't have been aware. Okay. But one thing I will say though is that, like, regardless of how your pathway into teaching, like, turnover is awful. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's bad for Teach for America teachers, but it's not significantly better for teachers that come through like traditional certification, like 4-year bachelor program. And so the students are used to people not making it through the year, not sticking around. So there's a lot of, you know, well-earned cynicism that you have to overcome.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, is this dude even gonna like last, you know, like 2 weeks, or is he gonna peace out? Like,
right,
you know, probably a lot of my students that had that experience and people just quitting on them.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
one of the most important things is like, basically no matter how messed up your day is, like, the worst thing you can do is like kind of take a day off after, you know, like it's one of those like, get down, knock down 7 times, rise mm-hmm. 8 or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever the numbers mm-hmm. are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Things,
yeah, yeah.
You know, you're gonna be like one of those people who can't be kept down, and you know, you definitely that's how you kind of earn the respect of the students and the buy-in, but like, you know, that you're in this with them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's yeah.
And I'm curious too, what made you want to get involved with Teach for America to kind of start with?
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say this, like when I was going to college, I studied computer engineering, and that's mostly because I was, I'd been programming since like probably middle school. Yeah. And so it seemed like the obvious way to go. But as I was like doing internships and stuff like that, I was finding like the work really uninspiring. Okay. I think having to do with like the particular places I was working, it kind of the stage of my life, wanting to like really do something that felt like it had meaning. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel like my work was, as an engineer, was giving me much of a sense of meaning.
Okay.
And so I'd actually been thinking, going into my senior year, like, what would it take to, like, you know, to get certified as a teacher? And, you know, maybe that's like what I want to do. Cause I think that, like, going in, as I recall going into college, like, teaching was something that was sort of on my mind.
Okay.
I felt like, you know, I actually really didn't like high school or junior high, like those experiences very much. And there were a couple of teachers that I did connect with.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I in my mind, you know, I looked up to those teachers a lot, and it always kind of, it was always something in the back of my mind. Like, could I try and be like that, you know, those kind of teachers for students like me who didn't feel like, you know, like, you know, like, a strong connection, like
yep.
in school and stuff like that. And
yep.
So in any case, I was coming back to my senior year of college, planning on going to check out like the education school just to ask them, like, what are my options? And I, mind you, I already won the fellowship that would take me to grad school. So I knew I wasn't going to, it wasn't something I could do immediately. I was already going to be spending at least the next like year or two, like doing more engineering school, okay. But I still wanted to know what my options were. And I just happened to run into a dude who I was roommates with. I think we were both buying some beer, and we were catching up. I hadn't seen him, you know, for at least like 6 months since I had been out of the country studying abroad.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so we were catching up on like what, you know, each other's plans were like post-graduation. And he's the one who told me about Teach for America. I was like, oh, word, like, you don't have to take any classes like as, you know, in undergrad. Like, he's like, no, you can graduate with any bachelor's degree, and then Teach for America handles the rest of your training. And from that point, I was like, you know, I went home, checked out the website, like learned as much as I could, mm-hmm. and I was sold on the plan. Going into grad school was essentially like whenever I was done to go directly into Teach for America. I'd apply. It was like literally the only thing I applied for. You know, and had I not been accepted to the program, I would have had to scramble to find a plan B because there was no plan B.
Right.
I was really dead set on doing the program.
And I know I read too in your blog, it's pretty exclusive. They reject what, 6 out of 7 people?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it's difficult to get into, and I think for two reasons. Like, one, they're looking for people who have demonstrated some sort of record of exceptional achievement. Like, okay. They want to know that there was something somewhere in your experience, like, that you were going into something, the expected results were, you know, X, and what you deliver was like 10X, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they actually saw on my record to feel like.
you're selling yourself short.
But the other thing they look for is that you're just like simply not going to quit. Like that, like they want to know that, like, you know, when they, you know, kind of like what you were saying, when they put you in the classroom in front of the students, like that, no matter what happens, like, you're going to keep showing up day after day. And at least for those 2 years, like, you know, you're going to be 100% defendable. Mm-hmm. And that's as important as like, that's at least as important as like anything else. Unfortunately.
Yeah. You
know,
yeah.
I mean, really it should be like, you know, ideally it's like, how well do you know the material that you're teaching? But that's like that's a distant concern, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you brought up something that, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but like I've seriously thought about going into education.
Oh, yeah.
So a couple things have held me back from doing it. One is basically, and I know this is kind of shallow, but the pay is horrible and the region I'm in North Carolina, it's horrible. The teachers have gone on strike a few times. They've had marches down and rally to increase pay, but it's one of the lowest in the country here. And I don't feel like that's right. And, you know, another reason that I haven't really kind of pursued it as much as I want to is there's just like, I don't want to say like, it's not a fear, but it's more like, I don't want to let kids down. So
right,
like,
right, for sure.
Kind of what you were saying earlier is like, there's certain teachers that I remember that had an impact on me. Not a lot. Like you said, I didn't really connect with, especially in high school. There's maybe two teachers in high school I can say that I really felt like I had a connection with.
Yeah, same here. Two, maybe three.
Yeah.
Four most.
Yeah. Yeah. Junior high, before I moved from Connecticut, I had a pretty good relationship with most of my teachers there. Once I moved, it just kind of, I had no relationship at all. So one thing that always stuck out to me is like, the teachers who impacted me and kind of stick out of my mind are ones who kind of showed an interest in me and saw potential in me and helped me to kind of reach down and do more. So my question is, like, what kind of impact did you want to have, like, going into the classroom on students? Like, what was your mindset going in day one?
Yeah, I mean, I think like fundamentally, I really wanted to, you know, I felt like I had learned a lot about the path to college and like how to kind of unlock a lot of opportunities, you know, from a life perspective. And mm-hmm. and for me, college was such a turnaround from high school. Like, it felt very disengaged in high school, and in college, having yeah. like the freedom to choose my own schedule, to set my own, you know, to just like the agency that I felt like I had lacked so much in high school. Like, it was like, yeah, I really wanted to like kind of enable that for the students that I taught, you know, mm-hmm. You know, and I think having like a strong connection with them was like more of like a secondary concern to me going in. Okay. I think what I learned is how important that is, because you kind of have to, like, they have to trust you first yes. before they'll like believe what you say,
yep.
you know?
Yep. Yeah. That's huge. Yeah.
And I kind of struggled to establish that trust. But yeah, I mean, I think like fundamentally I was kind of driven by, trying to open doors for these students, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so another thing that really stuck out to me, and again, I saw this a lot when I was watching the show Last Chance High, students were cursing you out on a regular basis. Like, I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, for the most part, the way I dealt with that, I just, you know, I didn't take it personally. There's only a few things that that kids ever said to me that like really got to me. Mm-hmm. For the most part, though, you know that you're the punching bag for all the frustrations that they can't take out on people. Like, you know, that they you know, they're absorbing so many hits from different directions in their life in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And it, you know, the worst you can do to them as a teacher is really send them down to the office, you know, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. so you're kind of an easy target for that, like, projected frustration to come out at, you know. And, you know, I just try to keep in mind that it's like, for the most part, it's not really about me or anything that I was doing or whatever. You know, I tried to always, like, to always, always, always treat kids justly. You know, and to not, and so I always had the security in my mind that, like, I always felt secure that I hadn't done anything to wrong, like, that student. You know what I mean? Right. And so that makes it a lot easier to not take what they're saying personally, because,
okay.
Because you know, it's not about you. It's definitely, I think that probably changes if you, like, do something to, like, lash out, or, like, you make a remark back or whatever. Then suddenly the things that they're doing are justified, and you know, and it's easier to take them personally at that point, you know, because mm-hmm. you know you're kind of at fault for it, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Mm-hmm. And there definitely were a couple of occasions where it's like, where my discipline slipped, and like, you know, and I said something to a kid that like, I wish I wouldn't have said or like whatever.
Right.
But like the vast, vast majority of the time, I really just tried to like always like treat them, you know, with the utmost respect. And I think that, you know, in the moments where students weren't mad at me, that like I think that was something that they saw in me, you know. Mm-hmm. I had my students write reflections, but like the last day that I taught them, like, you know, if they wanted to and say they had to do it. But like, when they were done with their like final exam, it's like, if you want, you can take a blank sheet of paper. You know, I'm not coming back next year. Cause I taught the same group of students for both of the years.
Okay.
Something called looping. It's usually a middle school thing, but, okay. Our high school was a little weird. And so we did it, at least for the freshman, class. I was the teacher of the first group of freshmen at the school.
So your school started out as sixth grade, eighth grade, and ninth grade.
Right. Yeah.
And then your second year, did they, go like add a 10th and 11th and 12th grade?
So the second year, they basically just filled in at sixth grade because we had a group of eighth graders. They became the ninth graders.
Okay.
So then second year, we had 6, 7, 9, 10. And then the following year after that I wasn't there, they added a new sixth and ninth grade. Okay. And so at that point, it would have been 6 through 11. Okay. And the next year, just the sixth grade class. So then you have full 6 through 12.
All right. So if you would have stayed around, you probably would have advanced, like with your ninth, you advanced to 10, and then you probably would have advanced to 11 with them.
And I'm not exactly sure because it's difficult to do it in high school because people's tracks kind of diverge, you know?
Okay.
Okay. So it's real unusual to even do it from like ninth to 10th grade. Mm-hmm. But I think in many ways, for a lot of reasons, our school was kind of run as a middle school. Even though we had high school students.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little bit more appropriate for middle school to do the looping thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if they kept that up after I was gone. Okay. I doubt it.
Okay.
But in any case, like, so, I gave my students the opportunity to write reflections on, you know, on their time with me over those 2 years. And it was really fascinating. I really thought some kids would take the opportunity to really tell me a few things about myself, you know.
right, lights you up a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I didn't have the greatest relationships with 100% of my kids, you know. Some were great, some were really difficult, you know. And but like to a person, everyone who wrote something really self-reflective, really appreciative. And I was blown away by just how, you know, like just how kind of deep some of those reflections were.
Yeah.
And I was blown away that what I was trying to do, it did get through to them, like, really clearly, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Not even like on like a vague way, like they actually got it, you know?
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily come through in the day to day. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's gotta be a good feeling. I basically read through most of how your year one went. How did it go for year two for you? Like, do you feel like you made strides in year two and it went smoother or more of the same?
Year two was really difficult. I kind of went in thinking I was going to be better, but I think my expectations for how much I would improve versus like the reality like weren't matching up, and it was really frustrating. Like in some ways I found it more frustrating than year one, because year one it's like I had the excuse of like, you know, it's like, look, I'm doing my best, I don't really know what I'm doing, like, you know what I mean, like you get a certain pass as a rookie, but then when you come back for year two it's like that pass is gone, you know what I mean?
Right.
And right. You know, both from, you know, it was just like it was honestly emotionally even more difficult than year one.
Really, really. Okay, interesting. Well, Yeah, I appreciate you walking me through that. Like, I could spend like another hour talking about that topic, but there's a couple other things I want to talk to you about. So I'm gonna move on. Like I said at the beginning of this conversation, like, I've always regarded you as like one of the smartest people I know, and for sure, and like. You know, I see that you're really into politics, and you seem to be really against everything that's going on in our presidential office and just in politics as a whole. So, like,
I don't know where you get that impression.
I mean, I'm not gonna say I feel much different than you. You just express it better than I can. But so, I mean, like, my and this is very broad, but like, how the hell did we get here?
Yeah, that's a good question, man. Because I think it's bigger than like Trump, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's a symptom of the underlying problem. Like, if I have to trace it back, like, I think it's like, things were clearly going off the rails when Sarah Palin got nominated as vice president in McCain's campaign.
Right.
She was just like grossly unqualified to potentially be president when, you know, McCain, you know, he would have been like amongst the oldest people to become president. So there was a very real case that, or a very real chance that, like, you know, he might get sick and pass away or something like that. And mm-hmm. that, Sarah Palin would become president. Right. And I think that was around the time where it was really clear that the Republican Party had like truly abdicated its responsibility for like good governance. And it was becoming just more purely ideological. Mm-hmm. And it's only gotten worse and worse since then. You know, that kind of presaged like the Tea Party, like, you know, Michelle Bachmann, Joe Walsh, like all these people who were just like very, very deeply reactionary. Steve King, like, you know, just a lot of really, I don't know, really like sketchy and kind of, I don't know, like willfully ignorant people getting into high office. Mm-hmm. So obviously I think Trump is just the culmination of that process. And I guess as for like why it's happened, I mean, I think Obama's a big aspect of it. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I think is one of the most brilliant living writers. Like, he kind of wrote this searing essay. I mean, at this point, that's sort of what he's known for. Like, most of his essays are searing, about how like the election of Trump was essentially a reaction to Obama's election. Right. And it was like the ultimate, like, the least qualified white man is more qualified than the most qualified black person, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was like the statement that was made in Trump's election, you know what I mean? I think there's a lot of politics of spite that are totally overriding like the actual issues that we, you know, that we need to address like in this country. Unfortunately, we're kind of just like sinking more and more as politics becomes more of a like team sport than like about actually, you know, improving the lives of Americans and people across the world and the environment and like all the things that are like, you know, that should be our primary concerns, you know?
Right. Yeah, honestly, yeah. From my perspective, I feel like it's gotten to a point where there's such division on both sides, where there's no ground that's going to be made up because no one is listening to each other. It's kind of just become a shouting match on both ends, and that to me signals that there's going to be no progress, or that's not a way you can operate. So, you know, I definitely see that as a big problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I kind of like, on some level I agree, but on some level, like, I think that I don't think it is like a both sides thing, like, because I think that, like, there are people who are like just as like radically leftist and like, you know, want to hear nothing from anybody else, and like those people do exist, but that's not what the Democratic Party consists of. I think what you kind of have is like Democratic Party today is basically conservative in the literal sense of like not making any radical changes to anything, right? Like, that's sort of what the heart of conservatism is. And the Democratic Party, by and large, is composed of people who think that more or less we're like on the right track as a country. Right. Like the Republican Party's become like reactionary in the sense of like, we've got to go way back. We got to make America great again, which, like, you know,
what does kind that of even like mean?
Yeah, or like for whom, right?
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
Was America great at one point, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Because for a lot of people, it's only recently become great, you know?
Right.
And,
right.
I think what you kind of have right now is like one party that's like trying to hold the center, the other party that's trying to bring things in the far right direction, and then like a fringe of people who are like more truly like, you know, I guess, like highly progressive or something, you know, like if you think of like Bernie Sanders, right? Who's like barely in the Democratic Party at all, right? He was independent for much of his career. You know, so it's, I think it's a little bit dangerous to think of it as like both sides out of whack thing, when I think we're actually in a place that's like far out of balance. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So even going back to the election, I know like leading up to it, it just didn't even seem like Trump becoming president was a real thing. And I remember sitting down, I'm watching the numbers coming in, and I'm seeing Trump is in the lead, and I went to sleep. And I was like, I know when I wake up in the morning, you know, everything will be what it's supposed to be. And I woke up the next morning, I turned the TV on, and I was like, whoa, this is real. So, like, and from your perspective, coming to the next election, like, who do you see as the biggest threat to taking over? Or do you see Trump getting another term?
It's I wish I knew, but I think all bets are off. We're in a space where the Democrats don't have a clear position, really, other than like not Trump, right?
Exactly. Like, right.
There's still like, oh, go ahead.
I mean, you can't put Hillary back out there in front. I mean,
right.
I just don't think
Hillary's career's over.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of like Bernie still is like is actually the most popular politician in the country, but he's going to be quite old for the next election.
Right.
I think you got like other people who are kind of standouts. You know, you got Cory Booker. You've got like whoever Hillary's VP guy was, Tim Kaine.
Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people who are plausible, but. You know, it's difficult to say. I think right now it's impossible to say whether Trump will finish his first term. You know, you're starting to have people who, like, you know, I was just reading an opinion article in the New York Times written by a sitting Republican congressman who's on the House Oversight Committee talking about how Trump is compromised. Mm. So there's starting to be a consensus that something is, like, horribly, horribly wrong right now. You know, after this whole like Putin summit thing, like totally surreal press conference.
Right.
there's no guarantee that dude even finishes one term. I think one of the things that's difficult to say though is like there's a difference between what, you know, what people in government, you know, who are kind of like who have more expertise, like think and believe, and what the electorate believes, right? So So who knows on election day, like what actually happens. The one thing I will say though, is that it was easier for Trump to win as someone who has no record whatsoever. Cause like he literally held no actual public offices until becoming president.
Right.
It's a lot more difficult to win when you've established a record, I personally think that it's unlikely that he's able to win another term, even if he runs. I think it's probably more likely that he declares victory. Like, I did all the things I said I was going to do in my campaign. 4 years was enough because I'm twice as good as any other president who's ever held office. Yeah. Like, you know, I'll catch you on the flip side. And then he's like off to like Switzerland or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes he can't get prosecuted.
Right. And, exactly. Right.
So I think that's pretty likely. But, you know, but all odds, you know, you're talking about like, I don't think you could put any outcome above 10% because it's just like, it just seems like anything to happen, you know?
Yeah. So, a couple more questions. So, this whole Russia shit, like this is real, huh? Like, this is like, we should really be taking this seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was clear as day, like, well before, like, you know, the election even happened. Like, you had Trump openly say, like, you know, I wish Russia would hack, you know, or would find the rest of the emails or whatever, right? Like, he's inviting a foreign power to hack a candidate for president. It was, like, it was totally surreal, you know? So none of this is, like, is surprising, really, in any way. It's, like, it's all been, like, clearly on the surface. Dude didn't release his tax records, which is, like, what every single other presidential candidate, like, you know, in our lifetimes has done to be transparent with how their, what their finances are, what the potential conflicts of interest are, all that kind of stuff, right? It's almost weird that like anyone should be surprised by anything that's happening nowadays because it's been so transparently messed up, like from the beginning, you know?
Yeah, no, honestly, yeah, nothing surprises me. I mean, I think it's still crazy that he's able
to... It's surprising even though it shouldn't be, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, and just the fact that he still operates a Twitter account, like, how is that... How? Why?
Like, yeah, it's so surreal. It's so surreal.
Yeah.
I don't know how anyone can look, you know, can say with a straight face that everything is, like, okay, you know?
There's a lot of people that do.
I have to flip it around all the time, man. It's like the dude is exactly who he's always said he was. You know, his record of sort of just unscrupulousness is so clear. So it's not his. He's not pulled the wool over anyone's eyes. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's not him that's the problem. It's kind of us, right?
It is. It's our culture. It's, you know, we're obsessed with the wrong things, the Kardashians, and, you know, we see, even Instagram, like, you know, it's cool. Like I probably use Instagram for different reasons than most people do. And I feel like most people, try to portray a life or a lifestyle that they might not necessarily be living on a daily basis. They want to make things look better than what they are. I feel like it's a culture thing, and people see Trump and they see he's got hotels across the country and they see he's got golf courses and, oh, he makes so much money and he's got a TV show. And I just feel like it's a product of our culture right now.
Yeah. I'll try and get into this I could talk about this for a long time, but I think we're kind of right now. It's a crisis of how do you know what's like true, or like how, you know, we're in a spot in the world today where so many things like under the hood are so complicated, right? Like you used to be able to, you know, if you had a car that's built before like 1980, like you as a regular person can like take apart that engine and rebuild it, you know?
Right.
But if you have a Tesla, like there's no way you can understand exactly how that thing is working. It's all proprietary. It's all hidden away. And that's how our entire society is like increasingly. Right. And so if no one can actually see like how anything is working, then what do you trust? Right. Yeah. All you can trust is like what's in front of you, but you have no no access to like the underlying facts, you know?
Right.
And that's sort of the problem that we have right now is like it's everyone's disconnected from like the actual fundamental knowledge of how things work. And we're just going even further in that direction. Like when, in my field in software engineering, like, you know, neural networks and machine learning have really caught on and they're producing amazing results. But what's wild is that even researchers don't know why those results are so amazing. Like there's this, everyone's playing catch up to try and understand like what it is that is actually happening. Meanwhile, we rely on these things to generate predictions for our businesses, to do speech recognition, to, you know, to even like imitate like human beings and stuff like that. If you saw some of like Google's like most recent stuff, mm-hmm. we don't know how it actually works. Right. So I don't know what the end point of that is. Like once everything becomes too complicated for even experts to understand,
right.
Cause it just makes it easier for people to make bad decisions because it's just, you know, I don't think it's the fault of people. It's because we're building, you know, it's what our, you know, it's not like a moral failing. I guess I'll put it that way, right? It's like, it's just the reality that everything is becoming more complicated than like human beings can hold in our own heads. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yep.
And I think it's only going to become a bigger and bigger issue that we have to like actually grapple with.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Especially as technology keeps becoming more and more a part of our daily lives for sure.
Yeah. It's not just that, but it's almost like, you know, technology, but it's also just like knowledge, generally speaking, like the number of things you could possibly know, like technology, but for any field are exponentially growing and it becomes impossible to know
everything. Like,
yeah. Or anything, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Everything's advancing. Yeah.
So I mean, that's like, people who could think that the earth is flat right now. It's like, the earth is not flat, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons why we know the earth is not flat, but it kind of comes down at some point, it kind of comes down to like, who do you trust, right?
Yeah,
like,
right.
And if the person who you trust says the earth is flat, then, you're, you know, that's as good of, you know, it seems more intuitive, right? So maybe that's just the truth.
Yeah. You're right. If there's someone you trust is telling you that, you're going to believe it.
Yeah. So I don't know, man.
So there's one last question I want to ask you, and you kind of alluded to this, but you think Trump getting impeached is actually like a possibility or a reality?
It's a possibility. I think it would depend on some just like blatantly obvious, you know, piece of evidence coming out, you know, mm-hmm. but I think it's unlikely. Like,
yeah.
And I don't even know if it would be a good thing.
I was going to say, do we want that?
Yeah. What we want is for him to resign. Like that's the best possible outcome.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know, maybe Ivanka would be like, look, we've done all we can. It's only going to get uglier for here. If you walk away now, you know, and obviously she's going to have to present this as somehow it's like the, you know, he's winning by doing this. You know what I mean?
Well, that's going to assume that they talk. And I think that's assuming a lot right there.
Yeah. I don't know. So I kind of hope that it doesn't come to impeachment, that he resigns, but definitely it's definitely possible.
Yeah.
But it kind of comes down to public opinion, because that's like, it's not really about like were crimes committed or not or whatever. It really comes down to does a Republican Congress feel like it would be popular with their constituents to have Trump like removed from office? I think because that's really unlikely. Like, unless there were just major shifts in public opinion, I think that's what makes impeachment unlikely. It has nothing to do with, like, you know, with truth or falseness or you know, or crime or anything objective, you know?
Right. All right. Well, yeah, like I said, man, I see you're passionate about it, and I respect your opinion. So I definitely want to talk with you a little bit about that. But the last thing I want to talk with you a little bit about, and again, you kind of have alluded to it throughout our conversation, but you're a software engineer.
Yep.
And I know pretty much since I've known you, you've always been doing stuff with computers and working on different software. So I know this has always been like a passion of yours, but like, what exactly does it mean to be a software engineer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's a broad field, and like, I guess effectively, you know, it's all programming, right? You're trying to build systems that you know, we're kind of surrounded by software everywhere. Like, mm-hmm. I think people think of software as running on like computers or phones or whatever, but like even kids' electronics, we both got kids and stuff like that. Like, even yeah. these things, like, yep. you know, they have processors. Someone's got to program them to do what they do, program how, you know, how like the speakers work for producing like all the sounds that they produce and all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. we're kind of surrounded by software, and broadly speaking, that's like, you know, the field that I'm in. The okay. part of the field that's like okay. blown up are like web applications and like phone applications. And okay. kind of what we're going through right now is like so many things that used to exist offline that we've mostly done offline are being made into experiences that you interact with like via like your computer or your phone. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting space because it's not so simple to translate these things that, you know, you used to walk up to a counter and work with a human being to try and like, you know, do your banking or to like buy groceries or whatever. And it's taken a long time for a lot of these things to translate their way into like the software world because it's really nuanced and you have to account for a lot of different, you know, different exceptions that might happen, you know? Like, and that's one of the reasons why this field has blown up so big. Yeah, I guess that if that kind of answers the question a little bit of like what, you know, I think a lot, so much of software has become like invisible, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like reveal a little bit of like how much software there is surrounding us and why there's so many of us who work in the field, you know, there's so much demand for programmers.
Do you see like the end product? Like, so say, yeah, you're working on like a kid's toy. Like, do you know that's what you're working on?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, okay. I mean, you typically be working for a company that like is making, you know, is making like the end product. Like, so the software will just be like one part of it. If you're working in like consumer electronics or, you know, consumer products or whatever, okay. like you would typically have like, you know, like let's say you're working kids' toys or whatever, you'd have software person doing like the internal like programming of whatever chipsets inside of the thing. You'd have an electrical engineer, like, you know, designing like the actual circuit board and like how it gets powered and all that kind of stuff. Mechanical engineers designing the physical, like actual thing, you know, a number of like definitely designers as well who are less doing like the technical work, mm-hmm. but more like the conceptually, how is this thing supposed to work? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, to be clear, I don't work in like making toys. So, you right. know, that's,
okay.
Okay. Not from personal experience.
Gotcha. No, I know. We've got plenty of those type of toys at the house, and I'm sure you do too. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, totally.
So, like, if there's someone listening out there right now that's interested in trying to go down a path that you've gone into with software engineering, like what kind of advice would you give them or like what would you tell them to do?
Yeah, so I guess I think a couple things. Like I think it would be helpful to have some idea of like what sort of software like they want to work on, you know, because it's just a wide field. you know, and I think probably an obvious answer for a lot of people is like, web and mobile apps. And I think that's a good choice for a lot of people because there's just like a explosive amount of demand for people with that skill set.
Yeah.
And I think to get started in that space, it's actually like easier than it's ever been. Like when I was a kid, like you had to, it was really difficult to just install the tools that you would need to like make software. And nowadays, like your web browser, you can open up the developer tools in like Chrome or something like that, and you can actually poke at like the inner workings of like a web page that's like on your computer. I think a good place to start is sort of with like, you know, is with web programming, like learning HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And there's a lot of good tools for that. There are things called like, it's like a code pen. So like CodePen, which gives you a little environment where you can set up some HTML, CSS, and JavaScript all in one screen and then see like the outcome in like a little window. And I've used that in the past to kind of like teach people like intro to programming type stuff. Okay. I think starting with web is like a really good way just because the cycle of like doing something and then seeing an end result, it's like probably like the shortest like round trip cycle, you know?
Right.
There are other types of programming that, you know, there is a longer arc before you finally get to, you know, get the feedback of like, did the thing you tried work? You know what I mean?
I you know, apps are so big right now. I think what you're saying is 100% correct. Like that's the way to go. Cause that's the wave right now. Everyone is trying to create apps, or there are apps that's what everyone uses on their phone and their computers. So yeah, that's the way right now.
Yeah. And the other thing I would say about that is that in some ways, like, I think it's easy to look at like, you know, like iOS apps or whatever, like iPhone apps as being like kind of a bubble. And in a way they are, right? Because like for a while it was like everyone felt like they need an app for whatever it is they were trying to do. And I think that in a sense that's a bubble, but in another sense, I think we're only at the beginning of like the amount of software that's gonna is gonna like kind of like surround us in every way. So I think it's as much as like one specific part of the software space might be a bubble, the skill set I think is going to be highly in demand for the foreseeable future. I think it'll be a long time before the robots put all the software developers out of work.
we won't be in the Jetsons life for a while.
Yeah, for sure.
That's good news. Well, Alan, man, I appreciate everything, man. It's been a great conversation. And I definitely want to give you a chance to shout out your social media handles if you want people to follow you on there. But before we even get to that, I like to end last question I like to ask in the podcast is, since I know you have a daughter and your daughter just turned one recently, right?
Yeah, 2 days ago.
How was her, what'd you guys do for her birthday?
Yeah, so it ended up being like almost three different birthday celebrations. So yep. Like the big plan was like a week ago on Saturday, we had like a massive party at Jen's grandparents' house, which is like out on the Jersey Shore.
Okay.
And my parents came up for that and everything. And that was like on like the 14th. Our actual birthday is the 18th. So we ended up having like another smaller kind of like party on our actual birthday. We felt like we couldn't like do nothing, you know? And then my siblings couldn't make it for like the main party. And so they came up before the 4th of July. And so we also did some celebrating then too. So it's been like a month of Natalie celebrations.
She's already starting my birthday celebrations all month. She's already getting started with that early. Hey, nothing wrong with that. So my question is, man, you've been a father now for a year. What kind of advice would you give to another father or an expectant father out there?
Yeah, man, I should be asking you that, man. But, you know, I think one of the things that I learned, I really had no, you know, my sister was a baby, you know, when I was like six. So I don't remember that too well. And I haven't been around too many like infants or anything like that. So a lot of things I was like just learning as I went. And I think one of the things I realized in the process is that there's like nothing that's like, you know, I think I thought I was going to need a lot more knowledge, like, you know, by like some deadline or something like that. Right. I think one of the things that's been interesting to like experience is that like in reality, like her like needs evolve like really slowly, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not like very few things are just like, oh wow, surprise, you got to like do this new thing that you didn't realize, you know.
Yeah.
I think what I've kind of learned is that it's like as she evolves, we kind of evolve around her, you know. Some things that we used to do, like they stop working so well, and then you find new things and you do those for as long as they're going to work. And I think that's like the biggest thing I've learned is just like, you know, yeah, like we tried to get as much things prepared around the house for her to, you know, when Jen was like getting towards the end of her pregnancy. But it's like, you don't have to childproof the house before the kid is born. Like, they're not going to like,
you know? Yeah. They're not moving. They're at that, you know, for the first 4 or 5 months, you know, they're eating, sleeping, going to the bathroom. Yeah. That's about it. You know, you'll get your smiles, you get your cries, but yeah, there's not too much going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's more, you know, it's more of like a leisurely pace, you know, more of a marathon than a sprint, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Once the sprint starts, man, it doesn't stop. So,
yeah, no,
just get ready.
Have it, like the flight that you took.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, man, this is like, yeah, this is what I've got coming up.
Yeah, yeah, get ready, man. It's an amazing thing, but it's definitely something that tries your patience and like makes you have to really kind of go find different parts of your personality and different parts of like who you are that you may not know that existed. Kids are a different experience. It's a great experience, but like it's a different experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would be your number one recommendation for now that I'm entering like, you know, proper year two, age one to two, what's your one single biggest piece of advice,
man? So do you have her sleeping in her own room right now?
Yeah.
All right. So that's a great thing. Keep that going. So my other thing would be be into like, so at this point now, and you've already mentioned like the technology thing, kids are going to now, she's going to start wanting to see like YouTube if she's not already seeing that stuff. She's going to be wanting to kind of like listen to songs and stuff like that. I would say really at this point, just like, have fun with that with her, because those are the moments that like might seem kind of lame, but like she's gonna love them. She's gonna like be laughing with you, and that's gonna really start to create a connection. And then like, you know, as she starts getting older, really just starting to evolve with her and just showing interest in like things that she's interested in. And I feel like that just like keeps that connection going.
Yeah. Oh man, that's great advice.
Yeah, that's. I mean, yeah, my daughter is like into a lot of different things. So like, even as much as I hate it sometimes, like I'll play the same song 20 times in a row because that's what she wants.
Yeah. Do that. Like Natalie's really into Moana right now.
Oh so yeah. Like... Oh yeah. Yep. We were listening to the soundtrack last night.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. So, I mean, yeah, just like little things like that, man, just like cherishing those little moments, because like those add up, and like those are things you're going to remember, you know, as you get older.
Yeah, that totally makes sense, man.
Yep. So, yeah, like I said, man, if you want to go ahead and like shout out your social media handles, go ahead and do that.
Yeah, sure. So I'm not super active. Probably the best place to follow me is like on Twitter, which is ALANJAY, and then like the digit one. That's my handle on Twitter. Other than that, I don't really do too much. I guess I also have aside from my teaching blog, which I don't really actively write now that I'm not a teacher anymore. Right. I have like a regular blog, which is acjay.com. Okay. I post, I don't know, whatever I feel like posting, really. It doesn't really have a strong theme. Lately, it's been like sort of like the stuff that that I'm really working on just from a household finance perspective. Okay. To try and go from like, you know, being like comfortable but like kind of disorganized with our finances to try and like really like, you know, be like much more systematic. So yeah, that's lately what I've been writing about. You know, I'll probably mix it up and write about tech, about politics, if I really get to keeping that up. But that'll be where to find like the vast majority of what I write.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I know I said it earlier, but I think people should go back and read your teaching blog. And again, that's alanjteaching.wordpress.com. You know, I saw you went back recently and updated it with a recent post, and I won't even say what it is. Yeah, I think everyone should go and read that. You should write a book, man. Like that's a book.
It's a book's worth of material, that's for sure. As it turns out, someone who also taught in Baltimore wrote more or less the same book that I would probably write. Like, it's called Teaching in the Terror Dome. It's like a pretty wild title. But I read that book and I'm like, damn, she wrote the book that is like, I think it's really fair. There's also another Teach for America teacher, but she taught like a few years before I did. Gotcha. It really kind of captures I think she was really fair about her school, about Teach for America as a program, about, you know, a lot of aspects of the experience, which I think is like I think it's like the most important thing. So I'll probably keep my blog in blog form, or if I ever like look to get it published, it'd probably like keep the same. I don't think I would edit it to become like more of a, you know, more of like a linear kind of thing, you know. It probably more or less stay the same as it is, you know, but I wrote it thinking that it is possible that it might, you know, I might try and like publish it someday.
Yeah. I know. I enjoyed reading it, and I think a lot of people would too. It reminded me, and I can't remember the name of the book right now, but when I was in college, for one of my classes, I had to read a book about a journalist who went undercover as a waitress and wrote a book about it. And that's what it kind of reminded me of, just like the realness of it and just really taking you into that life and kind of really seeing what it really is on a daily basis. So, you know, I really enjoyed reading it. I didn't get through it all, so I'm going to finish it. But yeah, I definitely recommend it to anyone out there that's listening. It's definitely a good read.
Yeah, and if you're considering doing Teach for America, it might be a good thing to read. Like for anyone out there who might be considering the program, if you want to have an understanding of like one person's experience. But I should emphasize that like everyone who does the program or is a teacher is going to have just like a totally different experience. So it's just like essentially my own experience and the things that sort of, you know, like I went through, and a lot of it's colored by, you know, what things that my own strengths and weaknesses and all that. One thing I tried to do, and if everyone else is like, you know, one thing I tried to do is like make sure I was always trying to reflect other people, like my students, my peers as teachers, Like, I really tried to be as fair and as positive about other folks as I could be, while also being like honest, you know.
Yeah.
So one thing I will say is that as much as some of the posts are, it can be a little dark at times, you know. Like, that's also in the most positive light I could put things.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's by far the most intense thing I've ever done in my life. I'm really happy that I you know, for the most part, kept up with writing as I was experiencing it.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, so Alan, man, I appreciate your time. Loved having you on here. And
we should do it again sometime.
Yeah, we should definitely do it again sometime. And hopefully I'll see you soon, man.
Yeah. All right, man. Take care.